This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Tracy, big week in Rochester.
Yes. Earlier in the week, there was the Individualizing Medicine Conference here in Rochester, bringing together some of the best minds that think about genomics and are working on the human genome from around the world.
It's really been interesting the past 13 years since the mapping of the human genome. A lot has happened since then, and I think the future is brighter than ever.
Coming up, our guests will include Dr. Eric Green. He's the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. And also Alex Parker. We spoke with him last month just a little bit. He is the associate director for the Center for Individualized Medicine at the Jacksonville, Florida campus. He'll be joining us as well.
We have a lot to learn today because I don't know that either one of us is really familiar with this topic of genomics and individualized medicine, but it's a huge field and it truly is the future of medicine. And we'll also talk with a genetic counselor at Mayo Center for Individualized Medicine, Ms. Kylie Johnson.
Our first guest is Dr. Eric Green. He is the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Green, you're the head of the federal institute that is charged with researching and advancing genomics to improve human health. Did it start out that Congress set you to work on this task?
Well, they created our institute actually once upon a time as an office, and then we became a center, and then we became an institute. But we were originally created to lead the U.S.'s effort of the Human Genome Project, this large international endeavor that went from 1990 to 2003 that essentially elucidated the sequence of the human genome.
And for the last 10 years, what have you been doing?
Well, and in fact, as you might imagine, with the completion of the Genome Project in 2003, you know, many questions asked, well, now what's next for the National Human Genome Research Institute? And we immediately, literally the day the Genome Project ended, we laid out an agenda, a vision, a strategic plan for what's next in genomics that really talked about the opportunities for using genomics to understand biology, using genomics to understand health and disease, and also to think about the societal implications of genomics. And that was a very important blueprint for us that guided us for the first 5, 6, 7 years beyond the Human Genome Project. But in fact, our advances were so significant that we found we needed a new strategic vision. And so we published yet a new one in 2011 that very much speaks to the steps that are needed to progress from understanding how the human genome works to understanding its role in human health and disease, and then thinking about how to apply that for clinical medicine.
Explain to our listeners, I mean, I'm definitely the layperson here on this one and not the medical person. So explain to our listeners how genetics and the Human Genome Project and what direction that we're going and the future of medicine that is here. Explain what it means to a patient.
So what it means, one way to think of it is, you know, you wouldn't feel comfortable bringing your car into a mechanic if that mechanic had no idea what the parts were in your car or how those parts went together. How could they figure out what part was broken if they didn't even at least have a parts list? And yet the way up until very recently we've practiced medicine is by having physicians take care of patients without really understanding their blueprint. Not really understanding how everything's put together, the code that puts it all together, the instruction book that puts it together. Genome Project was about opening up and reading that blueprint and having it before us as scientists to understand it, and then eventually as physicians to better treat patients. And the reason that's important is that every disease has either an overt genetic cause or something in your genome is different, or at least has a genomic influence. And now we are empowering physicians and other healthcare professionals to better determine the best medications to give people, to get better ways to treat cancer, get better ways to diagnose disease by not being blind to each patient's unique genome, but rather being able to use that information to guide treatment, to guide diagnosis, to guide prognosis, and so forth.
In the past, patients that would show up with breast cancer, for instance, you would just look and say, well, here's what most women who have been diagnosed with this have responded to. But now you can actually look and see, here's what you will respond to best.
Well, not only that, exactly what you said, you take a disease like breast cancer, and I'm a pathologist, and so I'm familiar with how this is done, is that you would look at something under a microscope and you'd say, well, this looks like this kind of breast cancer, so we will treat you this way. What we are learning, which is actually what we already knew, is that, you know, half the women, you know, responded well and half the women didn't respond well, even though their tumors under the microscope look the same. We are now learning that, sure, they may look the same, but if you use your magical microscope and you go down and you look inside the DNA of those two kinds of breast cancer, it's very different. The things that are broken in the genomes of those two different groups of breast cancer patients, it's very different. And now we are actually getting better and better understanding of why half of them responded well to this treatment and half of them did not. So it was that we were simply blind to our ability to better stratify, to better break up those patients with the same diagnosis, but really had two underlying diseases.
So you spoke about cancer and the big impact that genomics has on cancer, but also about the drugs. You need to say it for me.
Pharmacogenomics.
Pharmacogenomics.
It's a big word, but you know, but you just put it together. Pharmaco, pharmacy, drugs, medications, and genomics, understanding of our blueprint. Why is it that everybody responds differently? I mean, to lots of things, including medications. I mean, when I give lectures and I have an audience in front of me, I say, how many people either have taken a medication or have a family member who took a medication and it made them sicker? And everybody raises their hand. Everybody has examples. Why? And yet that medication worked great. It just doesn't work great in everybody. And we're now learning that the reason why we're either good responders or bad responders is that there's little subtle differences in our DNA that influence how we metabolize drugs. And that it makes some of us a good responder or a bad responder. But we've been blind to that up until now. And so what physicians do is they say, take this medication. If you don't do well with it, I'll give you a different medication. Wouldn't it make a whole lot of sense if you could know in advance who's going to be a good responder or a bad responder by a simple DNA test? And that's now the case. For dozens of medications, that's now the case. And so, and meanwhile, the other thing that's thought about is that there are some medications that never came to market because they failed during final testing because some people were really bad responders. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could salvage those medications and know up front that as long as you don't give this person with this particular DNA sequence this medication, then you won't have the harmful side effects of that drug? That's what's hoped for. And we really are at a pivotal time where we're learning more and more about the genomic basis of drug response. And that's leading to more situations where we can do upfront testing of somebody's genome to determine the best medication for them.
What has been a big surprise for you over the past decade or 20 years even of what the human genome can do or since it's been mapped? What's been something that has surprised you?
So let me give you two surprises, one technical and one biological.
Okay.
The technical advance is 10 years ago when the Genome Project ended. We had just sequenced the first human genome as part of the Human Genome Project, and it cost something like $1 billion. It's the best $1 billion we ever spent, but it was a lot of money. And we declared the day the Genome Project ended, we needed to develop new methods for sequencing DNA that would eventually allow us to sequence a human genome for $1,000. And we picked $1,000 because that was a reasonable clinical test. But going from $1 billion to $1,000, we said, oh, that'll just take, you know, 10 years or 20 years to get. And it's been shocking how quickly we've reduced the price. It's now well under $10,000 and we're only 10 years later. And I think none of us expected this to happen as quick. And I think it really is the credit of many people, creative scientists. It's a credit to our institute to fund the research and also the private sector to get involved.
Okay.
So that was one surprise. Technical surprise. I'd say the biological surprise is that I think what we had a naive view, I think, of the human genome in that we thought that most of the important parts of the genome were going to be those parts that encoded for proteins, protein coding genes. Genes are the parts of the genome that directly code for like the bricks and mortar that make up our cells, if you will, just the proteins are the major sort of building blocks of cells. We thought that's where all the richness was going to be. Turns out that only about 1.5% of all the letters or all the parts of the human genome directly code for proteins, the genes, the part we understand. And it now turns out that at least 2 to 3 or 4 times that amount of sequence is biologically important. is evolutionarily conserved across almost all mammals. In other words, that evolution has even tinkered with this because it's so important, and is functioning in ways other than directly coding for proteins. You may ask me, well, what's the kind of things that that other stuff does that's so important? Turns out our complexity is not in how many genes we have. We have roughly the same number of genes as worms and flies. Mm-hmm. If you look at a salad, most of the composition of a salad, they have many more genes than us, but we're really complicated beasts. We're the only ones that figured out how to read out our own genome sequence. So how are we so complicated? The reason we're probably so complicated as humans is in this other stuff, not the genes, but the non-gene functional sequences. And among the various functions we know of are circuits and switches that determine when and where genes get turned on and how much they get turned on. So for example, why is it that only a subset of cells in our pancreas makes insulin? Every one of our cells in our body has the genomic information for making insulin, but none of the other cells make insulin, just a subset. Why is it that only a subset of blood cells make hemoglobin? Every cell in our body has all the code.
Okay.
And the reason why is because it's incredibly complicated circuitry. I'm going to think of it like dimmer switches on the wall. And certain cells know what proteins they need to make, and they turn on the gene. They know when to turn it on, how much to turn it on, and maybe sometimes when never to turn it on. And all of that other sequence that's functionally important are these little circuits and switches. And that turns out to be much more important in some ways, or certainly it takes up more of the sequence or more of our DNA than does our genes. And I don't think going in, that was a big surprise.
Is it fair to say then that dimmer switch that you speak of, is that the genetic diseases that we can't figure out yet, is that dimmer switch playing a role in that?
It's a great question. Probably the answer is yes. It actually turns out that very rare genetic diseases, most of the defects in our DNA are directly affecting the code that gives instructions for making a protein.
Okay.
That's the majority of rare diseases like cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, and so forth. But what is also becoming clear is that more common genetic diseases like hypertension and diabetes and Alzheimer's and autism and diseases like that, where there's multiple genetic changes that all get together and then give you a greater risk for getting the disease. It's seeming that the majority of those are not directly affecting the DNA that gives instructions for making proteins, but rather is sort of flicking around with our dimmer switches, just a teeny bit. And there's probably like four or five switches. And if you're a little turned down here, you're a little turned up here and a little turned down here, that'll give you a 50% greater risk for getting hypertension if you eat this or you eat that. So it gets really complicated.
Interesting. Well, I don't know how you could say this in a nutshell or not, but what is your vision for the future? When you come to a place like this and everybody is excited and talking about what they've learned and what they know, what do you think is going to be happening in the future?
I think what the future is simply stated is that genomics is going to become relevant to patients and friends and relatives of patients, which means all of us. You know, and once upon a time, it was really mostly scientists that spoke the language of genomics. I think between now and the end of the decade, you're going to see a significant increase in the amount of genomics being discussed between healthcare professionals and patients. And that's a good thing because it means it's going to be providing opportunities to improve human health using genomic approaches.
And for just a touch of politics, does a sequester cut earlier this year or what's looming right now, we're recording this before October 1st. How does that affect what you do at the NIH?
It's tragic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's absolutely tragic. Our institute took a 5.8% budget cut, and that would be tolerable if genomics was boring, if it really wasn't much to do, nothing really exciting to think about, and we didn't see a potential for improving human health. But here's a circumstance where if there was ever a moment in time where we should be pushing the accelerator because just see at a conference like this, the opportunities are boundless and unprecedented. It wasn't this way 10 years ago, absolutely is the case now. And to not have enough fuel in our tank so that we could push the accelerator hard is truly tragic. And it also is particularly sad because, in many ways, the United States has led in genomics and we've written the playbook here. And what's very sad is the U.S. is not funding science as aggressively as other countries, and other countries are using our playbook and are going to move this faster than us, which is really seemingly tragic.
Dr. Green, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with Ms. Kylie Johnson on the role of the genetic counselor in individualized medicine.
Plus, myth or matter of fact, genomic discoveries can help cure genetic disease. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up. We're at the Individualizing Medicine Conference at the Mayo Clinic campus. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
All right, welcome back. We are at the Individualizing Medicine Conference 2013 on the campus of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And our next guest is a genetic counselor at Mayo's Center for Individualized Medicine, Ms. Kylie Johnson. Kylie, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
So a lot of us probably don't really understand what your job entails. Can you tell us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So a little bit of background, genetic counselors are typically masters trained in both genetics and counseling, and there's about 2,500 of us in the U.S. So we are trained to see patients. We work in several different areas. Genetic counselors can be in the laboratory, they can be in research and clinical practice, but as clinical providers, we meet with patients and talk to them about the risks, benefits of genetic testing. Does their family history seem to be suggestive of something genetic? If they were to do a test, what would that mean for them? What would be the implications for them? And kind of really help to support them through their journey.
Do you get your referrals from physicians?
We do, typically.
And a patient that you might see would be whom?
Yeah, so we work in all different areas, but to give you the kind of more standard ones, many times people who have a personal or family history of cancer might go and see a genetic counselor to say, are there lots of people in my family with cancer? What does that mean for me? Does that mean that there's a genetic cause for cancer? And if so, what would I do about that? And can I do more screening or surgeries or things like that? Many counselors work in pediatric care where they work directly with the medical geneticist, so a medical genetics doctor, and try to diagnose children that might have multiple abnormalities after birth, developmental delay, to say what's the genetic cause for their particular syndrome and what does that mean? How's it inherited? Counselors also often work in prenatal clinics. So if there's something of concern on an ultrasound for a baby, asking the questions of, is this genetic? Should we be considering any genetic testing? What will it tell us? What will that mean?
And so they might say to you, what are the chances that my child might have this disease?
Yeah, they might say that based on their own family history. So say, oh, I have a cousin with cystic fibrosis in my family. What's the chance that my baby's going to have cystic fibrosis? Or, what's my risk for Down syndrome in this pregnancy?
And what about the woman who has a strong family history for breast cancer? Would she come to you and say, do you think I should have this genetic testing?
Yes.
And so that's a big issue today, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
And what do you normally advise?
So genetic counselors are typically non-directive providers. We often just are giving facts and information based on the literature that's out there and providing that to the patient and helping them to think through in their own personal life, what are the benefits and what are the drawbacks for me to do this test? So typically as genetics providers, we don't advise someone to do a test or to not do a test, but we give them the pros and cons and help them walk through in their life's journey, what is this result going to mean for them?
So the buzzword today and at this conference also is individualized medicine. How has your role changed or how do you see it changing because of individualized medicine?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it has changed. It will continue to change. I think our standard previous genetics practice has been more so these single gene conditions that people have been coming in and wondering about, family history of cancer, specific pediatric conditions. But where we're moving to with individualized medicine and genomic testing that we're now doing is it's a much broader scale. So instead of a patient talking to me about just their family history of cancer or just a specific condition in their family, coming in with information and asking questions about looking at my whole genome, what is that going to tell me? So everything's a bit broader in scale. So I think what as counselors we have to do is adapt to that, adjust to the fact that I'm not going to be able to just talk about one particular hereditary condition, but we're going to have to make this global enough that they can understand the concepts.
And in your opinion, how do you think genomics and individualized medicine is going to change medicine? Will it be better? Will it be more complex? Will it be easier?
Mm-hmm. I think it definitely has promise to make things a lot better. I definitely think and already see the challenges that we're going to face, and that is that there's going to be a whole lot of uncertainty. So there's a lot of promise for what genomics can bring, but with every large-based genomic test that we're doing, whether it be a panel test or whole exome or whole genome sequencing, they're going to be getting back a whole bunch of variants that we don't know exactly what to do with. And so it's going to be a new level. We've always talked with our patients about uncertainty, but it's going to be a whole new level.
What's the biggest misunderstanding that patients or the general public has about the human genome or genomics?
I'd say one of the biggest misunderstandings is that if we identify something, that we're definitely going to be able to do something to treat it or fix it. So that's really...
Maybe someday. Huh?
Yes. I mean, yeah, we all have the hope for that to potentially be the case. But it's really one of the major things that I go through with any patient that I see is that we have the potential to identify a lot, but I cannot promise you at the end of the day that we're going to be able to do something that's going to drastically change your care based on this information.
So you might be able to identify, or someone might be able to identify, the abnormal gene and the genetic abnormality that's causing the illness, but you can't go in and change that gene right now.
Right, right.
It seems like you really enjoy what you do. You're happy about talking about being a genetic counselor. If some young man or young woman came to you and said, is this a good field? Should I think about doing this? What would you tell them?
I'd say absolutely. Genomic medicine is really where things are going. I think there's going to be no lack of the need for genetics professionals. I think we're already seeing that. So I would say absolutely it's a great field to be in. Are there challenges? Yes, there are with every field. And there can be some emotional challenges that go along with being a genetic counselor, perhaps giving bad news, things like that. But it's a really exciting field that you will never be bored in.
And you probably will be able to find a job the way things
yes.
are going.
Yes.
Kylie Johnson, genetic counselor at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. We are at the Individualizing Medicine Conference 2013.
Coming up, this week's health and medical news with Vivian Williams. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's one more reason to get off that couch and start moving. An American Cancer Society study has new evidence that shows moving more reduces the risk of breast cancer for postmenopausal women. They found regular, moderate activities such as walking was associated with a 14% lower risk, and more vigorous physical activity was associated with a 25% lower risk. Now, they're not sure yet why this is so, but they say their research is more evidence that shows being active is good for your health. And that information was published in the journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers and Prevention. And now, itchy, watery eyes, sneezing, runny nose, feeling stuffed up. These are some common symptoms of seasonal allergies. Learning how to avoid allergy triggers and finding the right treatment can make a big difference. Mayo Clinic Dr. Juan Carlos Guarderas explains how seasonal fall allergies can affect our health and how we can deal with possible complications. A chronic allergy problem can be managed when we have a clear diagnosis and an action plan to help us avoid complications and disruptions to our daily life.
Whatever exacerbates the nose and the eyes exacerbates the lungs as well. One of the good things about allergic disease is that it's somewhat predictable. So if you have an accurate diagnosis, you can anticipate what is going to happen. So if you had an accurate diagnosis of fall or weed allergy, you could start early on in the season with your nasal steroid preparation that will try to downregulate your immune response and hopefully make your season much more tolerable.
And now here's some information about how an investigational vaccine looks like it's effective against the most common strain of norovirus. That's a gastrointestinal infection that causes vomiting and/or diarrhea. Now, researchers from the University of Cincinnati suggest the vaccine reduces these symptoms by more than 50%. Now, right now, there's no treatment or cure for norovirus, and it's the most common cause of severe GI infection in the U.S. It's highly contagious, and it can hit child care centers and other places very hard. Now, the researchers say if the vaccine continues to prove effective, it could be used for those at higher risk of severe disease, such as the elderly, or for people in high-risk situations, like those in daycare centers or for people going on a cruise. Or they say it could be offered to everyone since all of us are exposed at one time or another. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio, information you want from specialists who know. This week, we're talking individualized medicine and genomics. We're at the Individualizing Medicine Conference 2013 on the campus of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
More information about this and other topics are available at our webpage, radio.mayoclinic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. And speaking of Twitter, a Twitter recap of the conference is available, Dr. Shives, at hashtag SimCon2013. That's CIMCON2013. You can find that at our webpage, again, radio.mayoclinic.org. And while you're at our webpage, we would love to read your suggestions about possible topics for us to cover on future programs. Just click on comments and leave your suggestions.
Our next guest is Dr. Alex Parker, Associate Director of the Center for Individualized Medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Dr. Parker, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
I really appreciate all the nice weather, too.
Yeah, I bet you do, and because you're used to warm weather. And we talked to you two or three weeks ago when you were back down in Jacksonville.
That's correct.
So tell us, individualized medicine, you're here. This is a big conference. There are a lot of people here. There's a lot of interest in both individualized medicine and genomics. Most of us don't really understand what these terms mean. How would you explain them so we could all understand?
Right. Well, I think it's important to always point out first that Mayo physicians have the goal has always been to practice individualized medicine. And that's the idea that when a patient comes in, whether it's a question about their risk of getting a disease, a question about how their disease should be treated, or a question about what their life's going to be like after that treatment, they want answers to those questions that are relevant to them. The answer should be individualized or personalized to them as much as we can. And our physicians have always tried to do that.
You're treating the individual, you're not treating the disease.
Exactly. We're trying to get answers to those questions that are personalized and individualized to that patient. And that's right there in our motto. The needs of the patient come first, not the needs of patients come first. But that patient sitting in front of you is the most important person in the room. What's so awesome now and why we have this big conference and why there's so much excitement is because our ability to do that has gone through this huge transformation because of technological advances in the field of genomics. And what genomics kind of centers on is our ability to explore DNA to look for causes of disease and predictors of response to treatments. You know, we've known DNA was the code of life for a long time, but our ability to kind of query DNA to get at specific answers to questions was really limited. It was like we had just a piece of the map. We could only look at little pieces at a time. Through these advances in technology now, we can look at the entire human genome, which as we talked about last time is 6 billion bases. 3 billion base pairs, you have two of each, so 6 billion bases, which is an enormous number. And we've only been able to look at a small percentage of that at a time as we did research or as we tried to bring genetics to the medical practice. Now, through these technologies, which we're hearing about, you know, at this conference, we can look at the entire genome and explore the entire genome, whether it's to go after research-based questions or, as we're trying to do here at Mayo Clinic, really drive this into practice and have it be a technology that can guide care. And, as I said, provide more individualized answers to patients' questions.
I think when people go to the doctor, you know, they have a broken arm or they're sick or they've got cancer, whatever their situation is, and the physician and that team helps to cure that condition to the best that they can. But what is different about genomics, and what I think is strange to understand, is that your genetics just are. So how is it how does that affect patient care when what the situation is that you just then know more about the person's genetics and what that means, and And how does that affect patient care?
So let me give you a couple examples that'll maybe drive that home. So first of all, let's talk about a field of pharmacogenomics, drug gene interactions. We all know, and I mean, I'll use the example of in my family. I have a younger daughter that when she takes a Tylenol PM, it doesn't really do anything to her. But if I take the same Tylenol PM, I don't wake up till 11 o'clock the next day and I'm groggy all day long. So clearly we all have different metabolism when it comes to drugs, and that's driven by our genetics. So there's an example of how when we're prescribing drugs, we need to use information to individualize the prescription of those drugs as best we can. And right now at Mayo Clinic, we are driving these things into the medical record through what's called decision support rules. So for instance, we know that people that are getting a certain drug that's used for HIV treatment, about 10 to 15% of people that get that drug can have very severe adverse reactions, including death. And that's something we want to guard against. So right now at Mayo Clinic, if a physician orders this drug, it's called Abacavir. If you order that drug, a warning fires up that says this patient should be genotyped to make sure that they don't have the mutation that means that they could have a very severe reaction to this drug.
Now, oh, well, so you could go back to the lab and do this genotype.
Exactly. Now, where we want to go, I want to give you the full picture here. That's great that we're doing that now. That's providing a warning system that says let's individualize the prescription of this drug to the patient. Where we want to go is that one day the patient's genome will already be in their medical record. It will be just in your medical record like your height and weight is, so that when that drug is ordered, the warning that will fire won't be you need to do genetic testing for this patient. The warning that will fire will say, in the background, the IT has looked at this patient's genome and said, this patient has this mutation, you should not prescribe this drug. Or in the cases of some of the other drugs where we're driving these through, we give alternatives to the physician. We say, you can't prescribe this drug because there's some danger here, but here are some alternatives. And that actually brings up a really important point. I don't want to digress too much, but a big part of all that we're doing here, and it's come up at the conference several times, is about physician education about this. This is exciting stuff. This is like when CT scans came through. This is like when antibiotics came through, and the promise is amazing. But there's a huge education piece here. We have to educate our physicians about what's happening so that when these things, these decision supports, for example, start firing, they know what they are and they know what to expect, and we can give information so they can act on that patient right there. It doesn't cause more confusion, but provides clarity. We want to be clarifiers, not complicators.
Now, we know, let's take another example. Let's take statins, for example. We know that, some 40 more percent of adults over the age of 45 are on a statin. Are you going to be able to look at the different statin drugs and based on the patient's genome, know which drug is best for that patient?
That's exactly where we are going. Yes. Right now we're starting with some of these drugs that are prescribed for very unique situations. Like I said, Abacavir is an HIV drug. So that's a very limited number of physicians that would be prescribing that drug. But where we are going, and a good example, you pick statins. We're not there ready to put any decision support rules in for statins yet, but Plavix. Mayo Clinic is currently conducting a trial to see whether genomic testing to get Plavix to the right patient is actually not only cost effective, but outcome effective. Now, other institutions have already implemented this decision support rule. Mayo Clinic is trying to do all the research behind it to where our physicians will feel confident that the level of evidence is there. But that's a drug, like you said, that is prescribed to thousands of people every day. So this, we're starting with some of the smaller ones where we've got our hands around it and we know what's happening, and we're going to be moving into exactly what you described.
We have a myth or matter of fact that we want to throw at you from earlier in the hour.
All right.
And
It won't be easy.
Do I get to know what they said? No.
Okay. All right. You've somewhat already answered it, but I just want to throw it out there. Genomic discoveries can help cure genetic disease. Is that a myth or a fact?
That is, in my opinion, that is a fact, but not a fact right now. Now, again, I want to be sure I want to be sure that I qualify that. So your question is, can we use genomics to cure genetic diseases? Where we are right now is we're using genomics to explore and find the causes of human disease, and then we're trying to use that to better tailor care. But and again, you asked if it was a myth or a fact. I say it's a fact because eventually, and we're not there yet, but the technology will be developed to do genetic engineering to fix damaged genes. So if we can use genomics to find the genetic basis of disease, and this gets back to Dr. Green's presentation. He did a fantastic job of sort of laying the landscape of the NIH roadmap for where we are. And he was honest that right now, Much of the work is in understanding the genome and understanding the biology of the genome and moving into how that causes disease. That's where most of the work is right now. But he showed a great slide showing that by 2020, and we hate to put dates on things, but he says by 2020, we'll be moving more into the therapeutic side. And he himself even included in that the potential that if you know this gene when it's mutated is causing a disease, you could fix that gene. And I won't go into the details because I don't like to talk about things that I don't know exactly the answer. But there are...
It's never stopped me before.
Yeah, that you could use genetic engineering to fix a, quote, broken gene. And really where we'd love to go is to fix these early on and be preventative. So if I have a 14-year-old daughter and she has genomic screening to find out that she has a gene that puts her at risk of, let's say, diabetes later in life, where we want to be is to where that could be fixed. So... my answer, very long-winded to your fact or myth, is that I believe it's a fact. It's well, well off in the future, but the whole, it's all predicated on our ability to understand the genetics of disease. So right now, genomics is helping us understand disease, and yes, one day it will lead to curing disease.
So sooner or later, you're going to have to get a test on everybody to get their genome into the system, right?
Exactly. That's where we want to go, is one day this will be hardwired into your medical record just like anything else. It'll be used as part of your daily care. We use an example of the future, and I like to talk about the future, and that's kind of my job, is to be the optimist in all this. The future will be that a family medicine doc will be sitting there checking their email one day, and they'll get a warning alert that says there's new studies out that have confirmed that the following genetic variant increases your risk of, let's use diabetes again. Behind the scenes, the electronic medical record will query all the patients in that physician's care and let him or her know, these are the ones that have that variant. Let's schedule a meeting to get people in so we can start doing preventative measures to try to reduce the risk that they will develop diabetes.
So how many do you have now? I mean, what percent of patients that you see, let's say in Jacksonville, have had, do you have their genome in the record?
So we have none. That is where we want to go. We have done whole genome sequencing on several patients, but we're using it right now for very targeted specific instances. We have two service lines open in our IM clinic, Advanced Cancer and Diagnostic Odyssey. So whole genome sequencing is being used to get answers for those patients about their care, and it's not being hardwired into the medical record yet. That's okay. Where we want to go. Again, that's my job, is to be, here's where we are now, this is exciting, this is where we want to go.
How all these researchers that are gathered here for this conference, how well do you all work together? I mean, right now we're still in the discovery stage of how this is working, and you're all here. It's so much fun to talk to you because everyone is so excited because you come here with all of these people who are the same mindset of you.
Exactly.
So tell me, how do all of these different research places work together?
We all work together very well now because this is so exciting, but also for another reason, because we have to. Our director for research here at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Greg Gores, has a great slide that he puts up now when he talks about the future of research at Mayo Clinic and pretty much everywhere. It's a picture of the outlaw Josie Wales. Do you remember that? The lone gunman. He puts that picture up and then puts a giant X over it and says the days of that researcher working alone in an ivory tower, making discoveries and changing medicine are over. He also puts up a picture of Einstein and saying the patent clerk working in an office that comes up with an algorithm that changes the world are coming to an end. We have to work together. We have to do these things. So to answer your question, we all work very well together because we have to the amount of data and patience and technology that we need to get after these questions and get answers requires that we work together. And then even just to make sense of it, this is about team science. This is not about individuals working in isolation.
Can you right now take a blood sample from Tracy and map her genome?
Yes. Yes. And what's exciting about that is, to put it in perspective, the first human genome took 13 years and cost $3 billion to map. That would not be what would happen if we took Tracy's today. Tracy's would take about 24 hours and would cost about $1,000.
Wow. And there's companies out there, Illumina comes to mind,
yes,
because I've read about this company and they sell you a machine,
yes,
and you put the blood sample in there and your genome comes out. Is that right?
That is exactly right. Mayo currently has, I believe, 7 or 8 of these HiSeq machines. And for years, the mantra in that field, in Illumina's field, was they wanted to get to the 24-hour genome. And again, let's think about that. 13 years to 24 hours is where we've come. Now, another thing I need to underscore is that's just to get the sequence. And there was a great paper written, I'm going to probably butcher the title, but it says the $1,000 genome, but the $300,000 analysis. So you've kind of led me to a great point I need to make, and that's that while the technology has come down to where we can sequence 6 billion bases in 24 hours, which is literally hard to wrap your head around. It's like listening to Carl Sagan talk about the cosmos. That's just the first step. We now have to make sense of all that. And where we have these sort of bottleneck right now, one of the challenges over the next 5 years is getting the analytic capabilities and the people together that can quickly make sense of what, not only what's in Tracy's genome that we can find and we know is actionable, but how do we talk to her about that? And I have just, one sentence, told you something that people could literally spend an entire conference talking about. First of all, how do we analyze it and how do we get the answers? And then the bigger piece, what do we tell her? What do we know is information that is going to help her and help her, you know, make her life better and make her, you know, her healthcare better.
All right. So we both have here at Mayo Rochester, and they may also have one in Scottsdale, but in Jacksonville, you have the Center for Individualized Medicine. Right now, which patients are you seeing? What kind of patients?
And real quick, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the Center for Individualized Medicine is foundation-wide. We're at all three sites. In fact, Gianrico, our fearless leader, you know, says we are not one center, three sites. We are one center. But your question is, one more time, what are we?
So who are you seeing now? What kind of patients?
Two types of patients are coming through the IM clinic, the individualized medicine clinic. Those with advanced cancers. These are patients that have failed all their standards of therapy, or they have a very rare tumor where there is no therapy. And we are using genomic sequencing to get clues to what drugs might work for these patients. Now, again, let's be honest. Not to sound crass, but these are the low-hanging fruit. These are the ones where they don't really have any other options.
Sure.
So one of the problems that we have is we want to drive this earlier into the process, but we have to be careful that using genomics to drive cancer care would be butting up against standards of care. And that's one of the challenges is if there's a drug that's a first line for renal cancer, but we do genomic testing that says that drug won't work, we should try something else. We've kind of put ourselves in a bit of a conundrum of this is the standard of care. The FDA has approved this drug. This is what the physician is supposed to give them. But now our information is telling us something else. So that's another challenge for the next 5 years is how do we get drug companies and physicians to agree that this is something that really should be driving their care. The second area where we're actually doing this now, where we are taking blood samples and sequencing genomes, is in what we call diagnostic odyssey. And these are patients that have a condition that they've never been able to get a diagnosis for. They've been all over the world to several specialists, and no one can figure out what's causing their disease. We feel there's a strong genetic component because either it affected them very young or they have multiple family members that are affected. And we are doing genomic sequencing to find the causative mutation for these people's disease. And just yesterday, we had two great examples, one by Doug Rieger-Johnson here at Mayo Clinic that told a fabulous story about a young couple that the father had a very rare form of kidney disease. And their question was a simple one. We want to have kids and we want to know if we're going to pass this on. How do we know if we don't know what's causing it? And they found the answer for them and gave that information to the patient. And now they can make informed decisions about not only his care, but family planning.
It's all incredible and exciting.
Yeah.
Dr. Alex Parker, Associate Director of the Center for Individualized Medicine, Mayo Clinic, Jacksonville, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, great. It's great to see you guys in person this time, too.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. And next week, sorry to say, Tracy, I'll be gone. You're on your own. But I bet
right.
You've got a great topic.
I do. And as a matter of fact, it ties in nicely with our topic today of genetics, as they often do. Dr. Stephanie Hines from Mayo Clinic Jacksonville will be joining us to talk about the genetics of breast cancer and how we use that to better treat breast cancer patients. Also, Tony Mangskow from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester Cancer Center will be with us, and we'll be looking forward to that program.
Well, you know, I'm sorry I'm not going to be here, and I guess it's just as well I'm not a woman, but every woman out there who, particularly those who have a family history of breast cancer, is going to be interested in this program, because the big issue today is, if you have a family history of breast cancer, should you get genetically tested so you'll know that you have an increased risk or not an increased risk for breast cancer?
And once you find out those results, what do you do with that information? Are you a watchful waiter or do you take action?
You're going to get the answers next week.
Yes, we hope that you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's programs, as well as previously aired Mayo Clinic radio episodes, or you can visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.